Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
It is the final episode of May on Legal Face Off, WGN, WGNRadio.com. It's also the final episode in our studios before we make the move. Rich Linkoff, Christina Martini.
Yeah, I'm so sad.
It's so sad. Yeah, the Titanic is going down. We'll be moving to a new shop. But guys,
I'm taking
this is
some.
It. As we
I'm
move
taking
across.
A piece.
I'm taking that WGN radio banner with me on the way out.
Yeah. I'm going to be the last if it's man not nailed standing down. At WGN.
He's going to be moving the equipment down. Out.
We'll talk plenty of things. Plenty of
like
things
the embassy,
here,
like the last members of the embassy on the rooftop in as Saigon fell.
We'll talk about lawsuits involving the NFL, an Obama Presidential Center project, plus school shooting in Texas, the legal grab bag at the end of the show, but we lead it off with Jamal Green, who's running for mayor here in Chicago, and he joins us as we kick things off.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Jamal, several weeks ago, you announced that you were running for mayor. You are one of a whole slew of folks that are running against Rahm Emanuel. You are the youngest mayoral candidate. You're 22, and you're known, as Ben said, for your community activism, particularly with the Black Lives Matter movement. What made you decide to throw your hat into the ring for mayor?
So I'm not just with my activism, and I'm not affiliated with the Black Lives Matter organization, but with the growing number of activists around the country who are standing up to political figures such as Rahm Emanuel. And I've been on the front lines in the progressive community as well, as I was a surrogate for Bernie Sanders and traveled around the country speaking before him. Talking about how we're going to move forward in so many issues that directly affect us. So being a surrogate, representing families, seeing these issues, seeing how leadership was not quick to address so many of these problems like violence and police reform and economic inequalities, they're not willing to step up and become and actually have leadership that we really need in this city. And I looked for who would be the best candidate to support for mayor, and I could not find one. And it was just a little divine for me to go ahead and jump into this race, and that's why I decided to be that person who has already been leading in these communities, but taking it to City Hall to be a voice for all of these, for all communities in the city of Chicago that are being that have so many issues plaguing their communities.
Jamal, there's at least eight candidates running for mayor. We've had on a couple of them, including Troy LaRaviere. There's also Willie Wilson, Gary McCarthy, Dorothy Brown, Paul Vallis, among others. How do you plan to separate yourself from the pack, and how would you become a voice on other issues? As mentioned, one of your core issues is dealing with what you perceive as the inequality in the treatment of police and some members of the community. How would you also speak to other issues to distinguish yourself from the rest of the candidates?
Yeah. So firstly, I'm glad that there are so many candidates in this race. That means that especially all these candidates represent different communities, different broad spectrum of issues, and it's an amazing thing to see everybody come to form. I mean, you know, everybody won't make it all the way through, but just to have these voices is amazing. How we're going to set ourselves apart is we have, so I've not just been talking about anti-violence. I've not just been talking about police reform. I've been very vocal and the progressive light of talking about economic inequalities, of talking about education and how we're going to move forward with that, talking about health care. And we're just going to continue to make sure that those platform pieces. So we presented the most progressive platform thus far than any candidate in this race. And this platform, which is on our site at greenforchicago.com, addresses so many different issues, and people can read them. We're going to unify different community groups around these issues and amplify those their voices, because it's important that we not just talk about one issue, not just talk about it. It's so many issues that people are affected by all over the city. And we're going to make sure young people are talking about this. We're going to make sure we're having town halls, whether it's in schools or in colleges and universities, We're going to make sure that we have a platform for everyone to voice their concerns and to unify them to go around this campaign and organize with us.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your platform as it relates to education?
Yeah, as it relates to education, we have a couple things. So one of the things is, of course, we have to invest in neighborhood schools. I think that's one of the most important things. We continue to not have adequate funding and resources for these schools. And once the enrollment is low because parents don't want to put their kid in a school that doesn't have the proper resources, then we shut them down. All right, that plan has been going on so many years, and it needs to end. Schools right now, they have 40 kids a classroom who don't learn the same, a lack of staff members, where the average is 56, and we got 37, a lack of clinical staff members, where we may have one person that's licensed, a licensed therapist possibly in the schools. A lot of schools don't have that. And so when you have a school that isn't doesn't have the leadership that makes sure that school makes sure kids can actually grow and thrive in that school, then you're preparing that school for failure. We have to change that process. We have to then have a higher education model in which, higher model we are presenting as a triangle initiative, where it's not just higher education, but it's trade school and entrepreneurial boot camp. So kids will be able to go to community college, trade school, entrepreneurial boot camp for free, and all they have to do is community service so that we can create tomorrow's leaders. We can create tomorrow's kids who want to create the new technology, who wants to fill these trade jobs that are empty, who want to open up their own companies. We have to create tomorrow leadership, and that's what our education plan is doing.
Jamal, you're 22 years old. You are trying to raise money to open a youth center in Bronzeville, targeting youth from 12 to 24. We have covered on Legal Face-Off the Never Again movement that rose up following the Parkland shootings. Why do you think now is the right time for someone who is relatively inexperienced, not just in politics, but in life, such as yourself, to become the mayor of the fourth largest city in the country?
Yeah, let me correct you real quick. As far as Madison All-Stars and the Youth Center building that we purchased was in Gresham on 79th and Ashland. And I stepped down as CEO to run this campaign, so the program is still going on.
Oh, great.
But as far as the youth around the country who are stepping up, it is our time to make sure that we are preparing the next generation future. All right. I think a lot of times we lose sight in the fact that a lot of the decisions that politicians make today is drastically going to affect the next generation instead of things that we may see tomorrow. And it's up to us to step up and make sure that the next generation of kids have better schools. The next generation of kids have mental health facilities. Next generation of kids don't have to be scared to walk in their own communities without being gunned down. The next generation is not dealing with so much corruption and pay-to-play politics. If we don't give Chicago a new slate, we're dooming the next generation and continuing the cycle. It is up to us and young people across the country to step up and take a stand. The old way has not been working. The old way has been going on so many years. Now this is the time. This is the best time where we have a political environment like this and people that are fed up with the state of politics to give a new slate. We can do that right now. Fresh ideas with fresh plans, with fresh faces, progressive faces. We can do it.
I couldn't agree with you more, Jamal. Just promise me you'll join us after you you get the position.
Yes, definitely.
Fantastic. Jamal Green, mayoral candidate. To learn more about Jamal's campaign, you can visit greenforchicago.com. Jamal, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble, and selected for many years as one of America's leading leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
We roll along on Legal Face-Off on WGN, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here, and we are joined now on the phones by Ari Freilich, who's a staff attorney at the Giffords Law Center, GiffordsLawCenter.org. Ari, welcome to Chicago.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ari, you've been with the Giffords Law Center since 2015, and you're an expert on gun safety reform and mental health policy. Last week's school shooting in Texas has again, unfortunately, drawn attention to the issue of how kids get access to their parents' guns. Texas apparently has a law aimed at parents whose children get access to loaded firearms. Can you share with us what the specifics are relating to this law and why it may fail to go far enough?
Sure. So, this shooting and many others have, I think, properly shone a light on the fact that most school shooters who are too young in most states to obtain weapons themselves, the vast majority obtain their weapons from their parents or from a close family member. And so the importance of ensuring that gun owners responsibly secure weapons when they're not in use and they're not there to supervise their children or their minor family members is really important. 27 states have a child access prevention law, so a law that can hold parents accountable or adults accountable in at least some cases where minors gain access to irresponsibly stored firearms. And Texas is one of those. Importantly, Texas's law can be used even if the minor doesn't use the weapon to perpetrate harm against another person. Texas's law is a little weaker, though, than many other states in that, one, it only applies to those 16 and under. The shooter in Santa Fe was 17, so the parents, no adult really could be held directly accountable under the child access prevention law. It also only applies to loaded weapons. And that's a major gap because we don't know all the facts about how this weapon was stored. But if the parents, even if the minor was 16 or younger and the parents had stored an unloaded weapon out on the table right next to a box of ammunition, Texas's law would not have applied.
Which seems a little shocking, I think, right, to most people who would assume that it should be as hard to access guns in the home, guns and ammunition, as it is to, for example, gain access to a vehicle or gain access to alcohol. I was on the Bill and Wendy show here on WGN earlier this week, and a couple people and Wendy asked, you know, why is it easier to prosecute parents who let their children, you know, have access to these other things than it is to these instruments of mass murder? And by the way, I asked that question in the wake of news just breaking now that in Noblesville, Indiana, a teacher and a student were shot. So that's all happening right now. What's your thoughts in response to what I said?
I mean, I think it's an important point, and I think, you know, it's indicative of what we face more broadly. It's not just child access prevention laws. It's that in general. As a country, and in most states, we regulate liquor, cough medicine, cigarettes, in a much more stringent way than we do weapons designed to take human life. Right now, in most states in this country, any person can purchase an unlimited arsenal of military-style weaponry from a stranger on the street or an online classified ad without any background check or sale record, no questions asked. They can have unlimited quantities of ammunition, a lethal product, designed to kill human beings, anonymously delivered to their door like they're ordering a pizza. They can similarly, order bump stock trigger activators that convert their semi-automatic weapons to fire like machine guns that they fire 9 rounds per second, as we learned in the Las Vegas shooting last year. And so I think, we need to have a broader conversation, but absolutely when we're talking about vehicles, when we're talking about cough medicine, when we're talking about liquor, people understand that, these are products that can have harmful consequences. We're not trying to ban these products, but we're thinking that there should be, reasonable regulation to save lives. And that's what we're advocating for with firearms. And, I think it's important to emphasize that, essentially, I think a lot of people don't know how little we're currently doing in most states to protect people from gun violence.
I can think of very little that is more important than a child's safety and the safety of life. And in that context, what are the potential downsides of these types of laws that restrict access to firearms, restrict sales to firearms? What, beyond just the right to bear arms, what are some of the arguments that are being posed by the other side of this debate?
I think the most consistent argument you'll hear from the other side is folks who legitimately want to own a firearm for self-defense don't feel like they want any barriers between them and their firearm. The gun lobby has been very effective at I think a major sales tactic for them is making people afraid in their own homes and in their communities, of people breaking into their homes and convincing people. I think there's recent survey data that shows women are particularly likely to store their firearms unlocked and unsecured around children. We hypothesize that maybe because they've been more the target of gun lobby messaging and marketing around about being afraid in your home. And so I think there is an element of the community that wants to store their firearms loaded and unlocked so they can access it immediately. Unfortunately, what we see is that vastly, vastly more people are dying as a result of unsafe storage of firearms, particularly children, and also when those children bring their guns to school, than lives are being saved in self-defense incidents in the home like that.
And not just from shootings, right? Because access to these firearms is a major reason or a major tool that people are using to commit suicide. That's a major fallout from this. Let me ask you this last question before we let you go. In the wake of Santa Fe, we saw the lieutenant governor, who got a lot of attention by talking not about the need to curb firearms or guns of this kind, but he talked about the need to limit access to schools. Now famously has referenced the need to eliminate the amount of doors to the school. That was followed. I watched Oliver North, who is now with the NRA, talk on the Sunday shows, or at least one Sunday show, about the need. The real cause is too much Ritalin and too much access to violent video games. You're with a group that was named after Gabby Giffords, who was the victim of gun violence. How do you react when you see leaders just moments after these tragic shootings, in some occasions, talk about these other, relatively small solutions to a major problem without talking about the need to reduce guns and access to guns?
Yeah, so
that's a lot to unpack.
No, I mean, it's important, and there's a pretty simple response, and it's that we can have an ideological difference of opinion about what needs to be done about or what we're willing to do to prevent gun violence, but we have to be honest about this basic fact. No other developed nation on Earth endures routine mass shootings or epidemic levels of gun violence inflicted on their residents, not one. And it's not because they have different school security designs, school construction designs. They're young people are watching the same movies and playing the same video games, in many cases using the same medication. The difference is the guns. And if we start at that basic fact as our starting point, if we can at least have consensus about that fact, then we can have a meaningful debate. But it's important for us to recognize this is not an act of nature. This is not something that happens to other people in other lands. This is a choice that we have made in this country by doing nothing in the face of repeat tragedy to allow it to continue. And so we can't prevent every act of violence. But just as, antibiotics have an eradicated disease, but they make a really big difference. And so that's what we advocate for, are reasonable, common sense measures that have been proven really effective where enacted here in the United States and elsewhere to save lives from violence and make these tragedies less frequent and less lethal when they do occur.
That's Ari Freilich from the Giffords Law Center, giffordslawcenter.org. Ari, appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
We roll along on Legal Face-Off on WGN, WGNradio.com. And joining us now on the phones, he's a public defender, a civic educator, and he also wrote the book, Chicago is Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve. Tom Tresser, Tresser.com, joining us on Legal Face-Off. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show.
Tom, you co-founded the group Protect Our Parks, which is a group that has filed suit in federal court asking a judge to enjoin the city and park district from transferring 20 acres of Jackson Park to the Obama Foundation, which is the nonprofit that will oversee the development of that part of Chicago for the Barack Obama Presidential Center. Yesterday, the city council, by a vote of 47-1, approved the plans. Does that make this fight and this lawsuit dead?
No. Well, listen, the original Protect Our Parks was founded in 2008 to stop the privatization of Lincoln Park when the Latin School grabbed a bunch of land there for a private artificial turf soccer field. A contract was signed, and the field was halfway under construction, and it was the same question. It's a done deal. Why fight City Hall? Well, we did fight, and we won, and the contract between the Park District and the Latin School was voided. So, no.
All right, so why are you and why are others, like Protect Our Parks, against the development of Jackson Park for this purpose? And, again, how will you overcome the city council vote of 47-1?
Well, there's a couple of points there. The overarching issue, I believe, is the transfer of public assets to a private entity. And I stand opposed to that under all circumstances. So we opposed the park, the deal in Latin, the Latin School in Lincoln Park. Then I organized No Games Chicago, and we fought the Olympic bid under the same grounds. You were transferring the entire city to a Swiss company for 7 years, so the entire city would have been privatized. And it's the same principle here. Jackson Park belongs to the people of Chicago. It is not the gift of the mayor, the city council, or even the former president of the United States. So is there, that's the principle, I believe, under which Protect Our Parks operates and is pursuing the lawsuit. So that's the first question. The second is a political question. Just because the city council passes something, is it right or correct? They passed the parking meter deal 45-5, the worst deal in history. So just because the city council rubber stamps a bad policy, a scam, a taking, doesn't mean it should be left alone.
So how exactly is this? This has been called in the complaint that was filed a few days ago. It's been called an institutional bait and switch, and has also been described as a short con shell game. What exactly is going on here that maybe our listeners are not privy to?
Well, okay, so the overarching concept I've just stated is you cannot transfer a public asset to a private company. That is wrong. And it would be like if in the middle of Central Park, where I'm from New York City originally, if Disneyland wanted to set a roller coaster up in the Sheep's Meadow. And the city council there passed it, that people would be rioting. So the first principle is the park public or is it not? Can it be given to a private entity for their gain? And the park, the project was sold to us originally as a presidential library, but it is not that. It is a center. It is a museum. It is an entity of the Obama Foundation, which, as much as I like and admire President Obama, he is wealthy enough, and the people surrounding him are billionaires. They could have bought land on the open market to build whatever they want. including the former site of Michael Reese Hospital, which the city demolished in a hurry to impress the IOC back in 2008. So buy the land on the open market. That's what advocates like myself have been saying for years. But this is Chicago, and it's been pay to play every day.
Well, wouldn't this, on the other hand, be a huge benefit to residents of that part of Chicago, which is not an area that has historically gotten a lot of attention in terms of tourism, in terms of tax dollars, in terms of money, in terms of visitors? How do you answer critics who say this would be a huge benefit economically, not just in terms of the jobs needed to build this park? One estimate is that there's expected to be 700,000 annual visitors, generating more than $3 billion in economic development. Is it worth losing that to this part of the city?
Well, first of all, I question everything you just said. Numbers like that.
That's why we call it legal face-off. That's what we like.
It's a little combative, but in a friendly way.
It's a friendly way. But listen, numbers like that are pulled out of people's you-know-what. And I would like to see the study that those numbers came from. If it's anything like the numbers they produced for the Olympics, which, by the way, was $20 billion and 325,000 jobs, it's completely fabricated. There's no justification for those numbers whatsoever. But your larger question is a very good one. What are we to do for the disinvested communities, the African-American and disinvested communities of the West and South Sides? We have to ask, who got them that way? And it's city people, the people who are in power, who are giving away our public stuff right now. That's how we got here. Mayor Daley and Mayor Emanuel are privatizers. They're gentrifiers. They're chasing African-American people out of the city. So if you were saying, let's really take a look at the good people of Lawndale and Englewood and what they really need is, this thing isn't going to give it to them. It's going to chase them out. So no, I don't buy that. And it's the same argument that they use to push all bad policy in the city. Somebody may get a little something good, but the rest of us is going to be bad. I've been accused of being anti-black development for all my work in the past, and I'm not. And this is not going to help the people who they think is going to help.
But in that case, and I know you answered this earlier by saying that this was a rubber stamp, but you know, there are members of the city council who have come out strongly against the mayor on many other proposals, including many aldermen who represent the parts of the city that you referenced earlier, the south and west sides. How do you answer the idea that all but one of them, Alderman David Moore, who represents the 17th Ward, came out in favor of this? And by the way, he didn't oppose it for the reasons you're stating. He just asked, how are we going to come up with $175 million for the infrastructure cost that the city is going to be responsible for?
Well, that's a great question. And the aldermen who voted for it without the answer are irresponsible and should be fired. So it's this same rubber stamp aldermen that have passed every single thing that Mayor Emanuel and Mayor Daley before him wanted since time began. There is no instance of our city council turning back a mayoral initiative. None. Zero. So for the last 2 years, we've had no public budget hearings whatsoever. Our mayor has retreated from a longstanding practice of taking his plans before the public. He's afraid of being chased off the stage, as he was in the South Shore Cultural Center 3 years ago. So these guys and gals who rubber stamp these proposals aren't worth the gunpowder to blow them up.
Tom Tresser joining us on Legal Faceoff, Legal Faceoff on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The book, check it out. Chicago is not broke, funding the city we deserve. Tom, appreciate it. We'll have to have you back on. Thanks. We wrap it up with our final guest here on Legal Faceoff on WGN, WGNRadio.com. Make sure you check us out on Facebook and Twitter and iTunes as well. You can always rate and review the show. She's from the Blackwell Firm. She is the Blackwell Firm, the president and attorney at the Blackwell Firm, theblackwellfirm.com. Sarah Blackwell joining us on LFO. Hi, Sarah. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
That's a record for use of the term Blackwell, by the way.
Hey, you plugged me pretty well. Thanks.
There you go. Sarah, you are suing the NFL on behalf of former Saints cheerleaders who are alleging gender discrimination. You had made an interesting proposal to the NFL to settle the case for $1 each in exchange for a sit-down with Roger Goodell. You gave the NFL a deadline of May 4th. Bring our listeners up to date on the proposal.
Right. So, pardon me. I made a proposal to settle all claims against the NFL for Kristen Ann Ware and Bailey Davis in exchange for certain things. One of them being, the main one being, that no cheerleading teams would be eliminated within 5 years, because I don't want that kind of retaliation to occur. The other things were a sit down with 4 hours to have a reasonable, good faith meeting, because we really just want change. They responded at 3 o'clock. The deadline was 5 p.m. And the response was, we don't settle anything, we don't agree to settle anything, but we would love to speak with you and have a conversation about information and recommendations, which I have been in pretty constant contact with their attorneys over the last several weeks since that time. And I really feel like they are coming to the table in good faith. I'm very optimistic with the way they're responding to what I'm talking to them and what we're doing. So I don't, you know, I didn't really care if it was Goodell or the janitor. I just want someone with authority that will give me an ability to collaborate with them and say, we want change. You know, we want this to be different. And let's figure out how this is different and come together. Because, I mean, we can keep you from being sued. We can keep you from having problems in the future if you would pay attention and say, look, cheerleaders, I hear you. And I'm not saying we did anything wrong, but this is what we're going to do to make the program better. And that's the goal. But, of course, my clients, Kristen Ann Ware and Bailey Davis, have a very strong claim, too, against the teams. And we never offered to settle those.
So is the sit-down actually happening? It sounds like you've been in pretty constant communication with their attorney. Has the sit-down happened yet? It sounds like it may not have. And if so, when will it happen? And what is the nature of their claims?
Well, the sit-down really, to me, was the part of the offer. One good thing is that they denied the offer. So if they are playing me or not really acting in good faith, I still have every right to sue them. And we didn't sign any arbitration agreement, or my clients didn't. So we can bring class action lawsuits, whereas with the teams you can't, because they signed arbitrations. But the sit-down with Goodell, I really don't. That wasn't the point of it. The point of it is making real change and working together to make real change. And I have given them proposals on ideas of how I think real change can be made. And then they go and talk to the people with authority. And we're going back and forth right now. And every time they come back to me, it's not, I expect them to laugh and say, yeah, okay, great, thanks. You know, thanks for that advice. We'll talk to you later. But they come back with specific questions, and it's a real lawyer-to-lawyer conversation where they're... So I don't know if there'll ever be a sit-down, and I really don't care if there's ever a sit-down, to be honest with you. All I care about is real change. And so far, moving forward, it looks like that they really do want that. Whether or not they're playing me, I don't know. If they're playing me, then we'll file a lawsuit against them. But if they're not, and they're serious about change, then I have no interest in money, and my clients have no interest in money against it from the NFL. We're interested in real change and making this an incredible experience for the cheerleaders that are there and to come in.
Can you elaborate for our listeners on what your clients' claims were, just to bring them up to speed on what was happening?
Yeah, Bailey's claim is gender discrimination because there are two rules that she allegedly violated and was terminated for violating. One is the fraternization. They cannot go anywhere near a football player. They have to leave a restaurant, a football player walks in. They're at a concert, they see a football player, they have to leave. That's any NFL football player. If they're caught texting with a football player, I mean, and I'm not talking dating, I'm just talking like, hey, we have a mutual friend or whatever. That's it, terminated. But the players don't have any rules like that. And they say in emails that it's to protect the cheerleaders from the predators because they'll prey on them and it's egregious, ridiculous stuff. But that's not allowed. They're similarly situated when it comes to contacting each other. And you can't say, okay, men, you can do whatever you want. Women, if you accept their attention or you don't run away, you're fired. So that was one, gender discrimination. The other one is social media. They can't promote themselves on social media, the cheerleaders. They can't put their profile picture having their uniform. They can't say they're a cheerleader. So they get paid like minimum wage, about $1,500 a year. So this is just a stepping stone to their next career, but they can't promote themselves and use it as that. So that was the other gender discrimination. For Kristen Ann Ware, she had 3 years at the Dolphins. Her third year started with the director saying, "So we hear you're a virgin." And she said, "Well, it's a vow I made to God." And they said, "Well, you took something pure and beautiful and you made it dirty." And from that moment on, they just mocked her and harassed her and spent a whole year, like, basically telling her she can't talk about God. She needs to tone it down on Instagram. And then just, I mean, she even was physically assaulted by the director at one point. So hers is religious discrimination, but it's also gender discrimination, because she stands on the sidelines and football players are allowed to profess their religion. They're allowed to thank God for things. So that was a gender discrimination for her. And she did go to human resources and complained about the religious discrimination, and things got worse. So hers is a retaliation claim as well.
Sarah, quickly, in a few minutes here, we'll be in our legal grab bag segment, be covering the Harvey Weinstein arraignment for rape. We'll be covering charges against Morgan Freeman. It seems like every day there are additional allegations of sexual misconduct by a variety of people, mostly men. I know that cheerleaders have probably had it far worse in years past. You know, there's probably stories that are much worse than your allegations. Your allegations are certainly very troublesome. Do you find that in this current era of Me Too, of women feeling more comfortable and safe to come forward, it has been easier on your clients to actually come forward with these allegations?
You know, the funny thing is, it is the perfect time to come out. And there are stories that I hear directly from cheerleaders of constant harassment. They're all harassed by fans, and they're taught to just smile and say, "Oops, I think your hand slipped," instead of saying, "Don't grab my," you know. But so they are taught in training how to deal with being groped and sexually harassed by the fans, and they don't have any protection from it, and they're not allowed to complain about it. So that is a very big issue. But women are, especially for these cheerleaders, they're terrified to come out and speak out. I mean, they talk to me because it's confidential. They won't even come out anonymous. They're so afraid. But the other thing is that the women are super hard on the ones that are coming out. Like, the women are the hardest on the cheerleaders that are speaking out. And they're like, "You signed up for that and you dress like that." So I'm very disappointed in the lack of support of women who are part of football or not part of football, saying, "No, I don't care what your choices are in life. You don't deserve to be mistreated. You don't deserve to be harassed. You don't deserve, you know, because you go out there and dance in the middle of the field, oh, all of a sudden you don't have rights." So I've actually been quite saddened by the response of women and the lack of response of women.
That's Sarah Blackwell from the Blackwell Firm, theblackwellfirm.com. Appreciate your time, Sarah. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Let's wrap things up. Legal grab bag time on LFO. Legal face off. Rich Lenkov, Tina Martini, Sam Paniatovich.
The time, also known
today,
as a time in the show when we could not pretend to be smart and just let loose.
And not, yes, pretend that we're nice anymore either,
right,
Rich.
Exactly.
Very much. Thank you. No, thank you. All right. We start with Harvey Weinstein, who has been arraigned. We're seeing Harvey Weinstein now. Arraigned.
Yeah, finally. So he his attorney arranged for his surrender yesterday in New York. This morning we saw him handcuffed, walking into court, and he went to his arraignment. He has, of course, pled not guilty. His attorney has said that he fully expects to be exonerated. Interestingly, I saw his attorney interviewed this afternoon. Interestingly, his attorney said, "You know, there's a long tradition of the casting couch in Hollywood, so this is no, you know, these actions are no surprise." He said, "I'm not here to defend Harvey Weinstein against accusations of misconduct, just criminal misconduct." So it looks like he's taking the strategy of, yeah, he's a bad guy and he did do a lot of things, just on these two particular occasions for which he's charged, being in 2013 and 2004, I'm going to get him off. I mean, you know, kind of a rough strategy, but he's been charged with first and third degree rape and committing a criminal sexual act in the first degree.
Topic number two, a gynecologist from USC has been accused, and now she's calling on the Senate president to resign. What's going on here?
Yeah, Dr. George Tyndall, who is the primary gynecologist at the Student Health Center at USC for about 30 years, has now been accused by several former students, including one that's represented by Gloria Allred, who we all know is a friend of our show and frequent guest on Legal Face-Off. The allegations are that he engaged in sexual harassment, sexual abuse over the course of decades. He allegedly performed pelvic exams inappropriately, made comments that were tantamount to sexual harassment, illicitly took photos, inappropriate photos of his patients. And in the wake of this, we have seen at least one lawsuit. We have seen 3,000 signatures on a petition started by the former student body president at USC calling for the resignation of the university president. The doctor has now left the school, but the really key point from a legal perspective is that there's evidence that the school knew about this misconduct over the course of many years and did very little to prevent it from happening. If that is the case, then there is greater exposure, not just for this doctor, both civilly and criminally, but for the university for failing to take action to prevent this doctor, once they had knowledge of these allegations, from doing it to other students. So this is a big story. The president, I do think, will resign. There's been, you know, I think 200 members of the faculty of USC have demanded that he step down. But like we saw in the Michigan State case, this has a lot of ripples, and the president stepping down, if he does, won't be the end of it.
So Morgan Freeman is in the news being accused of inappropriate behavior, also harassment. Morgan Freeman, not good.
Yeah, I mean, like we talked about earlier, it seems like every day there are allegations from against celebrities, new celebrities. This one is Morgan Freeman. I think most of us are surprised by this, although there has been whispers over the years. And now looking back at some of his behavior in press junkets, you know, it seems far more obvious than it did at the time. But there are women who have accused Morgan Freeman of inappropriate behavior on movie sets. One woman who was a senior member of a production team on the movie Now You See Me said that Freeman sexually harassed her and other female assistants on numerous occasions, that he made inappropriate comments about their bodies. He would not, he would say, for example, if they were coming by, that they should not wear any tops, they should show their breasts, that they should wear things that would show their clothes that would show their bottoms. You know, obviously behavior that is completely inappropriate. Another accuser says that in a room full of people on another press junket for the movie Going in Style, she alleges that Freeman looked her up and down and on more than one occasion said, "I wish I was there." That he said to her, "You are ripe." As well as some other comments. So Morgan Freeman, in the wake of this, SAG this morning announced plans to drop him from the union. Morgan Freeman has already apologized. He said, "I apologize for any behavior that has been interpreted as offensive." You know, hasn't come quite out and said that he admits to it. Sort of a, you know, I think a pretty terrible explanation, but as we've talked about today and over the course of many shows, we will continue to see these allegations as women feel more comfortable coming forward with what seems to be a pattern of years of abuse.
That's not really an apology.
It isn't, no.
It's what David and I call the sorry butt.
Sorry, not sorry?
Yeah, sorry. Yep. Well, we call it a sorry butt.
Yep.
Strange story here. Ex-Fisher & Phillips partner Tex McIver shot his wife to death in an SUV, but the details get even weirder because he says he's never been alone in prison. His wife is right with him. What is going on here?
You just ruined my story, Sam. So what's going on here is this story actually got a lot of rotation and was pretty popular over the past few days in a lot of the legal media outlets. So Tex MacIver, who is a former Fisher and Phillips partner, was sentenced to life in prison this week for the fatal shooting of his wife from the back seat of an SUV in which they were both riding. He was convicted of felony murder on April 23rd for the September 2016 murder of his wife. It looks like he's not going to be eligible for parole for 30 years, which would make him 105 by the time he's eligible. Judge McBurney sentenced him under a local law, which requires a life sentence, but also gives the judge discretion about whether or not the sentence is with or without parole. The strange set of circumstances are as follows. He was holding a gun while in the back seat of this SUV, and he claimed that it was because he was worried about how dangerous the neighborhood was that they were driving in. He claims that he accidentally shot his wife, who was in the front passenger seat, when he fell asleep. Prosecutors claim that he actually had a motive to kill her, that he was facing financial problems, and that he owed his wife hundreds of thousands of dollars at the time he shot her, and that this was at least in part because his law firm income had dropped significantly during the course of his marriage. He tried to counter those arguments by saying that he and his wife were very much in love and that they were able to telepathically communicate, which just demonstrates their very strong connection. And as you mentioned, Sam, he said
too bad that she could have read his mind about the fact that he shot her in the head, that he was about to shoot her in the head.
Yeah.
Too bad that part wasn't part of the telepathic relationship.
Yeah, I think that that would have helped her out in this
situation.
Hey,
I'm about to shoot you in the head. Maybe you want to move.
Maybe you want to jump out of the moving vehicle.
And I love you, but I'm very much in love.
Oh my God.
I'm about to shoot you in the head, but we're in love.
And since
sounds like every relationship Sam has had.
I was going to say, yes. It sounds like every relationship you had before you married your beautiful wife, Rich. So apparently since she passed away and since he's been in jail, he says that he feels her presence and that he never feels alone because she's always with him. I don't know about you guys. I have some doubts about this one.
But wait, he also, at trial,
thanked everybody.
No, he thanked everyone. Didn't say he missed his wife. Guess what he missed, Sam? Chick-fil-A. What? He misses Chick-fil-A.
No.
Poor guy.
Yes.
He's in jail. He's 75. Maybe he could still talk to his wife telepathically, but he misses his Chick-fil-A. Poor guy. There is no Chick-fil-A in prison in Georgia.
I feel so bad for him.
The lesson here is they need more good fried chicken breasts in most jails, I guess.
A couple topics left here. The dancing doctor has gone viral. Problem is, not a license.
Excuse me, sorry.
Yikes.
Wow.
Yeah, that was bad. Don't feel good. Yeah. Don't feel good about that.
At least five cc's of phlegm came out there.
I'd say 10.
Yeah.
Okay, that's just disgusting.
What do you want me to do? Sorry.
Talking about Rich and his monitoring of how many cc's came up.
Yeah, 10 cc. You know the band 10 cc, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know
the things we do for love.
You know the story behind the name of the band?
No, but the things we do for love is one of my favorite songs.
I'll let our listeners do the research, but the band 10cc and the band Love and Spoonful both named their band names for a very specific reason. I know David Sussler, resident legal expert and music historian, would know the answer, but
and part of the Sistini combo.
Yes, just look it up. But yeah, the band 10cc and also the band Love and Spoonful both named their bands for a very specific reason. I'll leave it at that. Go ahead, Sam.
Okay. Hopefully this is all edited out. Please edit this in the last...
No, that's
no,
all good
the
stuff.
10cc stuff should totally stay in.
Ugh. All right. Three topics left on the legal grab bag. The dancing doctor has gone viral. The problem is the dancing doctor isn't licensed.
Well, she wasn't a licensed surgeon. She was a board-certified and licensed dermatologist, but... Man, just when you think you've seen everything, this woman was posting videos, and like not even secret videos. She was marketing her plastic surgery practice, which is in Atlanta, by showing videos of her dancing to various songs while her patients are under anesthesia being operated on. On a couple of occasions, she shows the backsides of the patients. The problem, as you mentioned, Sam, is that she is not a board-certified plastic surgeon or a general surgeon, which, you know, generally you want from someone who's operating on you, who's cutting into your body. She's also settled 5 malpractice suits in the last 6 months, is currently being sued by others. She claims she has 10,000 satisfied customers. I saw an interview in which she discusses, she actually gave a deposition about a case in which one of her patients is now brain damaged as a result of her malpractice. And she said, you know, he should be happy because instead of paying $21,000 for this plastic surgery, I only charged him $11,000. So $11,000, brain damaged, I don't know.
I don't really think it's hard to do the math on that one.
Not the right amount of money. But yeah, check out the video if you haven't looked at it. It's pretty brazen.
This title says SpongeBob Restaurant Dispute. A SpongeBob Restaurant, question mark?
Yes. Haven't you visited it? It's in Texas.
No. Sam is the Squidward of our show, by the way. who would Tina be? Tina would be the...
I don't know. Who would I be?
Maybe Sandy, Patrick? You'd be the one, like, Patrick? She wears the, Sandy, the one that wears the astronaut suit underwater.
Yes.
Nice. I'm not sure what kind of commentary that is on me, but.
Who would Brian Watercutt be? Gotta harken back to Watercutt always.
All
no
right.
No comment by Sam on
yeah,
that
n- yeah, no comment. All so right, let's jump right in. So in 2016, Viacom, that owns the rights to SpongeBob SquarePants, sued IJR Capital Investments over its efforts to open a restaurant in Texas under the name The Krusty Krab. Viacom claimed that this was likely to cause confusion with the fictional workplace under the same name, which is featured in the SpongeBob SquarePants series. So it's a straight-up trademark infringement claim. A federal appeals court affirmed the lower court's decision this past week, which granted Viacom summary judgment on its common law trademark infringement and unfair competition claims in 2017, finding that the company actually owns a legally protectable trademark in the name The Krusty Krab. The Fifth Circuit found that the fictional restaurant's presence in the world depicted in the series and its lucrative licensing record for all things SpongeBob was enough to establish a valid ownership claim. The panel found it was that I find this an interesting statistic. The panel found that the Krusty Krab appears in over 80% of the episodes and clearly has a prominent role in the storyline of the series, as well as in the video games and licensed merchandise for the show. This was said to provide strong evidence that the Krusty Krab is actually a term that is an indicator of origin for Viacom's licensed goods and for the TV series. So it's interesting from a trademark perspective. I don't know if you find these sorts of things interesting, Rich, but to find that a fictional place in a series is actually sufficiently a significant enough indicator of source such that it's considered a trademark. I think it's pretty cool, actually.
Of course it's interesting, especially when you consider how much time I've spent and continue to spend watching SpongeBob. I believe in a place called the Krusty Krab, and there should be one.
There should be one.
Yeah, we should.
But under license from Viacom.
Correct. Absolutely. I've actually I've stayed at the SpongeBob Hotel with my kids, the Nickelodeon Hotel in Orlando. It's now shut down, but they were properly licensed.
Why was it shut down?
Viacom Corporation. The amount of urine in the water in the pool.
Oh, come on.
The amount of fecal matter running around that pool. It was a big water park hotel. Not the cleanest place I've ever stayed, but, you know, how many times will you get to stay in a hotel with Squidward watching you from the wall of your room? So it was fun. But now it's gone. So we move on.
All right. I am almost 30 years old. One more year. This story out of New York, a judge in upstate New York has ordered a 30-year-old man to leave his parents' home. What?
Yes. So 30-year-old Michael Rotondo was ordered earlier this week to finally leave his parents' home. Supreme Court Justice Greenwood ordered Rotondo to leave his parents' home in New York and said he is not entitled to 6 months' notice. He also ordered Adult Protective Services to investigate Rotondo's parents' well-being. Apparently, Rotundo's parents had given him several written warnings that he must leave their house. Their notes even offered to pay him $1,000 to help him find a place to stay and requested that he get a job and also that he sell whatever unnecessary belongings he needed to in order to afford to move out, including, quote, any weapons he may have in his possession. Rotundo apparently took his defense pretty seriously, and he actually researched his case prior to his hearing, and he argued on his own behalf that he was entitled to stay an additional 6 months, and he actually cited a case that supported the position that family members facing eviction are entitled to stay for a certain period of time. So what's interesting is that the judge praised Rotundo for his research, but he said, sorry, Charlie, there's an appellate ruling that overrode that decision that you just cited.
Get the hell out. Hit the bricks, pal.
So while, you know, you may be a lawyer in making, you didn't quite take that course in legal
research.
He's not
a lawyer in making. This guy's nothing in making. He's been told by his parents.
As proven by the fact that he's staying at home.
Yeah, they asked him, like, why don't you get a job? I mean, have you ever heard of this idea of maybe at 30 years old getting a job and paying rent? And he said, first he said, well, I don't want to live with my parents. Then he said, I'm not quite ready to move out. And his parents have now gone to court, as you mentioned, to evict him. I mean, and they gave him money. They even gave him $1,100. And he said he used it on other expenses.
Yes, which shall remain unidentified. But he also said he intends to appeal.
Yeah. I'm just putting my children on notice that come 18, you're gone. I'm not going to court to evict you. I'm just changing the locks. You're
have
out.
You served them with papers
have,
so that they know and have they acknowledged receipt?
I show them this case and said, if this is you, you're changing your name. You're changing your last name to Panianovich. Speaking of my kids, I got one good story here. Let me end off our legal face-off for the month with a positive story after rape and sexual harassment and evicting your kids. I spoke at my kid's career day, my second grader's career day at Agassiz Elementary last week on, being a lawyer. And they sent me this really nice, I'll show you guys, nice collage of thank you notes.
Are those on Post-its?
Yeah, I'm actually going to post it to our site so our listeners could hear. But, you know, really nice. One of them said, layers, L-A-Y-E-R-S, are awesome. Boom. Someone said, what does the Supreme Court look like? Someone said, I didn't know that lawyers help people not go to jail. Sam knows that for sure. Another boy wrote, you do good things. Someone said, thanks for teaching us about the Civil Rights Act. And finally, thank you for the pens.
Nice.
Kids love the pens. I did not bring our
you didn't bring the legal face-off pens
because someone didn't order anymore, but I brought them some Bryce Downey Lenkup pens. They loved it. So thank you to the second graders for having me, and I enjoyed telling them about the more aspirational parts of the law.
And what would those be?
You know, we do some good once in a while.
We have to.
Have you spoken at a career day, Tina?
Yes, it's been a while, but I would say a couple times a year, I go back to my alma mater, University of Illinois at Chicago, College of Engineering, and speak about alternatives to a career in engineering.
Sam, if we looked at a young Sam Panianovich notebook from, 1990-something, what would a young Sam in second grade have said that his aspirations are?
Your diary.
I wanted to be the moderator of Legal Face-Off.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sure.
All your dreams have come true. Now, for real, how early did you think you'd be into broadcasting and sports?
17 years old. So I wasn't young. It kind of fell into it in high school. So it wasn't something I thought about at 8, 9, 10 years old. But career days are fun. I actually did a couple career days myself, too.
Yeah, and you know, one day we'll all have careers.
When we grow up.
Yes.
Great way to end out the show. That's Legal Face-Off. Rich Lenkov, Tina Martini. I'm Sam Panianovich.
See you next time from the new studio, right?
Yes. Bye-bye, yeah. Tribune Tower.
We get our own dedicated Legal Face-Off studio, I hear, over there. Absolutely.
That's what I've been told. Uh-huh. I'll have to come back and visit.
The Jason Whiteside Memorial Studio.
We love
Jason. We'll talk to you in June. Bye. On Legal Face-Off. Thanks for listening.